Well, good evening. I am really delighted to be here among old friends and new friends, you know, people with whom I've learned so much about the Dharma. And before we get into the formal talk, I'm going to read a short poem by the 20th century poet James Wright. And I invite you to just let this little poem work on you without necessarily having to know how closely it does or doesn't connect with the evening's topic. Beginning by James Wright. The moon drops one or two feathers into the field. The dark wheat listens. Be still. Now. There they are, the moon's young, trying their wings. Between trees, a slender woman lifts up the lovely shadow of her face. And now she steps into the air. Now she has gone wholly into the air. I stand alone by an elder tree. I do not dare breathe or move. I listen. The wheat leans back toward its own darkness, and I lean toward mine. So the topic of tonight's talk is starting over. And it seemed like a timely topic because we're at the beginning of a new year in the Western calendar. I'd like to explore in tonight's discussion what the notion of starting over means in the context of our Buddhist practice and how we can use it skillfully. And I'll talk for a while, maybe about half the time, to lay some groundwork. And then after that, I plan to turn off the mic and we can have a group conversation. So, starting over a new year, we make resolutions. Anyone ever make resolutions? Anyone make resolutions this year? Yeah. Not everyone. It's one thing that we do sometimes, some of us. Here's a snippet from a recent New York Times article. Some of you may have seen it. It was printed just a few days ago. New Year's Eve is a time to set goals, to eat better, to save more money, to work harder, to drink less, and I might add for some of us to meditate more, to meditate better. It's day one on the road to a new you. But this road, as we all know, is difficult to follow. Humans are notoriously bad at resisting temptation, especially as research confirms if we're busy, tired, or stressed. By January 8th, some 25% of resolutions have fallen by the wayside. And by the time the year ends, fewer than 10% have been fully kept. And the author of the article goes on to say, unfortunately, the problem of New Year's resolutions is, in a way, the problem of life itself. So for me, and you can hear this in the passage that I just read, the phrase starting over calls up both wholesome and unwholesome associations, really useful and not so useful associations. So let's look first at a few of the ways that this talk of starting over, clean slate, can be helpful, can help us live or practice skillfully. First of all, there is a sense of possibility, a clean slate, renewal, that we don't have to be defined by the past. Change is possible. And, you know, the understanding that change is possible comes straight from the Four Noble Truths. Just to recap the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering or unsatisfactoriness. Unsatisfactoriness results from needing to have things other than how they are. Release from this dynamic is possible. Change is possible. And the path to release is the integrated path of practice known as the Noble Eightfold Path. And in the context of practice, I think it's fair to say that we're always starting over. Quite literally, the past doesn't exist. The past and the future are concepts. And actually, so is the present, but that would have to be another Dharma talk. And at the simplest level, in meditation, as we experienced a little earlier this evening, we start over with every breath. You know, this is one of the most basic skills that we learn as beginning meditators, and we keep relearning this as we practice. And I'm not just talking about the technical skill of returning to the breath when we notice that the attention has gone elsewhere. You know, even though, of course, that's a fundamental skill. But I'm also talking about the kindness and the willingness with which we return to the breath, or whatever we use as an anchor for our awareness. And similarly, in daily life practice, the way we learn to return again and again to awareness of the present moment's experience, and how we learn to return again and again to our most wholesome intentions. So those are a few ways that I think the idea of a fresh start, starting over, can be very wholesome and really dovetails with our practice. So now let's look at what might be less skillful in the notion of starting over. I think there can be an undertone or even an overt belief that we're not good enough. You know, a new you. What does that even mean? And I think the potentially unskillful or erosive aspects of this are at least twofold, probably more. At the most obvious level, we can be feeding aversion. You know, we have to change. It's a new year. I'm ready for a new me. What does that say about how I feel about the current me, the past me? And let's look at this from the perspective of the Buddhist understanding of karma. And for purposes of this conversation this evening, when I say karma or kama in Pali, I'm not talking about the cosmology of rebirth based on our past actions. Karma, at its most basic, is the way actions, especially intentions, condition experience. And technically, the word karma or kama just means action. So karma includes the way our intentions and our actions condition our experience and our identities in this very life. And from that perspective, why would we want to cultivate aversion? Why would it be a good thing to live or think in a way that perpetuates an aversiveness toward how we are? That just means we're practicing aversion. So more subtly, from the perspective of Buddhist practice, the idea of a new you may be perpetuating the notion of a separate solid self. And for those of you who have been around the block a few times, clearly this is at odds with the liberating insights of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, aka the three characteristics. And to recap, because I don't assume everyone knows what they are, anicca is the fundamental impermanence and instability of things. Anatta, or anatta, not self, is the understanding that there's no enduring, solid, essential self. You know, it doesn't mean we don't exist. It doesn't mean I'm not Laura and Rich isn't Rich. But that sense of a solid, separate, enduring self. And dukkha, which means suffering or a sense of unsatisfactoriness, which results from the delusion that objects and identities that are inherently impermanent and unstable could ever be a lasting source of satisfaction. the way we cling to having things that we dislike go away, or we cling to having things we like stay the way they are. So when we start kind of saying, I'm going to make myself a better person this year, we may be kind of reinforcing just those notions that are the opposite of some of the insights that we can gradually benefit from in practice. In other words, even though the idea of a new you or a fresh start recognizes that change is possible, so there's a little bit of understanding of impermanence, there still can be a reification of the self. Reification meaning that we make a solid object out of something that isn't solid or permanent. And there's another issue that may be even more fundamental. As I've already suggested, Buddhist practice asks us to look at the way that events and experiences are conditioned. If this, then that. If not this, then not that. That comes straight from the suttas, from the Buddhist teaching stories. And one definition of right view, which is sometimes called mundane right view, is understanding karma, the way that our actions and intentions condition experience. This includes taking responsibility. So from this perspective, the idea of starting over can be misleading if we take it too literally. I mean, of course we can start over and over and over. And I think our practice counsels us that we do start over in every moment. And, you know, one way that we start over is by continually renewing our wholesome aspirations, our intentions. But at the same time, we need to keep acknowledging the consequences of our past actions, favorable as well as unfavorable consequences. So, for example, how many people have heard the legend of Angulimala? You've heard at least a few Dharma talks where people have talked about Angulimala. So the legend of Angulimala from the Buddhist teaching stories, the suttas, says that Angulimala, who was a serial murderer before he abandoned his evil ways and became a fully enlightened monk. And the legend tells us that even after Angulimala became enlightened, he still had to understand and endure the hatred that his previous viciousness engendered. So when he went on his alms rounds, villagers threw rocks at him. And the Buddha basically told him, suck it up. And of course, you know, this is a larger-than-life example. It's a teaching story that for me highlights the balance between the real possibility of transformation. Change is possible. So if you want to call it a new you, I mean, you know, go wild. But at the same time, the importance of acknowledging what's come before, including our own past actions and intentions. So from this perspective, the term clean slate is misleading. You know, as we see in the Angulimala legend, when we start over, we don't actually get to erase the writing on the slate, but we can evolve a new relationship with it. This is similar to the discussion that many of us have heard about forgiveness. There's the saying that forgiveness is giving up all hope of ever having a better past. You know, you actually don't get to erase the past for the most part, but the relationship, the understanding of it, the way it's held in context, what we do with it can evolve and change. And even though I'm talking about the consequences of past misdeeds when I talk about the legend of Angulimala, we also benefit from experiencing and acknowledging the wholesome fruits of our past actions. So just to do a little thought experiment right now, giving ourselves maybe a minute or so of silence, why don't you take a moment right now to just reflect on fruits that may have arisen from your practice. And if you're new to this particular practice, to any efforts you've made in your life to live in a way that aligns with your own best values. And these fruits might be very subtle and incremental, or they might be dramatic. But, you know, don't think it through. Just take a moment and see what reflections come up. And for now, I'm not even going to ask you to share them. So actions and intentions plant seeds, and seeds may bear fruit. And, you know, we really need to grok that our past actions and intentions are part of a stream that includes our current and our future experience. And this understanding is fundamental to our practice. And actually, for this reason, our tradition embraces the idea of wholesome remorse. This is reflected in two qualities that are called hiri and otapa in the Pali language. And here's a passage from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is the great contemporary Western Buddhist monk and scholar, explaining these two qualities. He says, hiri is an innate sense of shame over moral transgression. Otapa is moral dread, fear of the results of wrongdoing. The Buddha called these two states the bright guardians of the world. He gives them this designation because as long as these two states prevail in people's hearts, the moral standards of the world remain intact. While when their influence wanes, the human world falls into unabashed promiscuity and violence, becoming almost indistinguishable from the animal realm. So we see that all of these popular notions, a new year, a fresh start, a clean slate, a new you, have both a wholesome side and a side that potentially undermines our efforts on the path. And I'd like to suggest a few ways that we can work with these ideas skillfully and then open it up to group conversation. So going back to the New York Times article, probably the most secular piece of this discussion, the author goes on to suggest, based on research, that when we focus exclusively on willpower, delayed gratification, etc., we can really exhaust ourselves. We can cultivate an unsustainable level of physical and mental stress when we just kind of try to do it better and force ourselves to. But he says when we cultivate wholesome qualities such as gratitude and compassion, qualities that inherently get us in touch with our interdependence with other beings, that our commitment to the behaviors that we want to cultivate is actually more sustainable. And, you know, for me, this way of discussing it feels a little too transactional, a little too, you know, if I do this, I'll get that. But I actually think it's an important start, and I think the points are well taken. So a related area for exploration is for us to look at how we can best cultivate resilience and stamina in our everyday lives and in our spiritual practice. And for me, resilience implies a continual ability to start over. So this could include a number of things. It might include, at the most basic level, taking care of both the mind and the body in the different ways that we know how. This could include tools and practices such as getting sufficient sleep, eating healthily, exercise, meditation, therapy. Clearly, it varies from person to person, but holding an intention to take good care of our relative selves, you know, even though this may seem obvious, it's essential. And you don't have to be a Buddhist or a Buddhist practitioner to understand this. fundamentally, we need to remember that there's an organism, that there's a nervous system. And any approach to practice that overrides this, I think, is not going to be wholesome or sustainable in the long run. So similarly, in our formal practice or in our daily life practice, cultivating a gentle persistence, you know, not over-efforting, not necessarily what we sometimes call willpower. Instead, again and again, a patient return to whatever it is that we want to cultivate. So the cliche, this is a marathon, not a sprint, really applies here. And those of us who, how many people have in any way practiced or been exposed to the paramis, the 10 perfections? A few people, yeah. So those of us who have practiced with the paramis or perfections might remember that both patience and energy in the sense of persistence are among these 10 essential qualities that, according to legend, the Buddha cultivated on the path to Buddhahood. And these are practices or cultivations that are recommended both for lay people, for householders, and for monastics, and obviously for aspiring Buddhas. So this patient persistence includes a level of kindness toward ourselves and toward others. When we fall down on the job, we pick ourselves up gently. We don't yank ourselves up. And I'd like to share a related concept from my Jewish tradition. The Hebrew word that is sometimes translated as atonement, teshuvah, actually means turning toward or returning, arcing back. And the Hebrew word that is translated as sin, chet, means missing the mark in the sense of an archer who misses the mark. This is not a blaming concept. It's a sense of continually returning, continually coming back to what we know best and to what's going to serve us and others best. So a related practice. Can we bring patience, and this is one that's very important to me in my practice, can we bring patience to the experience of uncertainty? Uncertainty about our lives, uncertainty about our practice, the subjective sensory experience of uncertainty, you know, real down in the dirt uncertainty, how it feels in the body, how it feels in the mind, how it feels energetically. Can we really allow experiences such as confusion, non-resolution, fear, not knowing, whatever it is we feel we want to know or we should know, not knowing, incompletion? Can we allow ourselves to really experience these experiences without freaking out? And if we can, if we're willing to, this is part of what we mean by beginner's mind. So beginner's mind might manifest as a graceful patient knowing that we don't know, if we're lucky. You know, or it might feel more turbulent and less graceful, but yet there's a willingness to hang out with things the way they are. It also has to do with letting go of our insistence on getting results now. So I was at a New Year's retreat, a meditation retreat, 7 years ago with John Travis. And in introducing the retreat, he talked about fallow ground. The idea that during winter, the ground may not appear to be yielding anything. Yet, something is happening under the surface. Seeds are waiting to sprout, and some of them will sprout if we feed them and water them. They won't all sprout, but things do sprout. And just to emphasize that beginner's mind is not conceptual. It's not just, I know that I don't know and that's okay. It's really about fully experiencing our experience. You know, the confusion, the muddiness, the flickers of clarity, the amorphousness, all of it. So a very wise friend of mine and a longtime practitioner in this community articulated it this way. Do we make an object of thinking we know what the practice is? You know, meaning having to make something out of something, having to make something out of our practice, as opposed to being present with the essentially undefined, ambiguous nature of our experience and sometimes the essentially undefined, ambiguous nature of our practice. One of my teachers likes to distinguish between awareness itself, the knowing faculty or quality, being confused on the one hand, and on the other hand, clear awareness that's able to know an amorphous experience. So that sounds like a mouthful, but it's actually, I think, very important. Really learning by paying attention to experience is the awareness, is whatever is paying attention muddy, or is actually, is there a rather clear, attentive awareness present, but what's being known is an experience of uncertainty, ambiguousness. We sometimes think that if our experience feels fuzzy or uncertain, that we're not being very aware. But it may be that we're being very aware of something that is that way, and we're used to thinking there are clear answers. So it's very meaningful to me to think in these terms and to experience in these terms that it's possible to be very present with experiences that are confusing, muddy, amorphous, uncertain, unresolved, and to really experience these in the mind and the body, the way they really feel. And right now, and you can, you know, kind of hear how energized I am when I start talking about this, this practice, just being with the stream of physical and mental experiences that are uncertain, ambiguous, muddy, and sometimes really uncomfortable, and certainly they're experiences for which I don't always have a convenient label, but this awareness, this willingness to be present with this kind of stream of experience is an essential part of my personal practice right now. And it's something that I talk about a lot with one of my Dharma buddies, how we can fall into the trap of thinking that practice looks or feels a particular way, or if our, in quotes, practice is working, that it should look or feel a particular way. Like it shouldn't feel fuzzy and confusing if I'm cultivating good awareness. No, maybe I'm cultivating good awareness and what I'm aware of is how confusing things feel. And when we talk about it and we try to go deeper than that, we realize that the words and the concepts that we use to describe our experiences are completely different from the experiences themselves. And when we patiently return the attention to the texture of those physical and mental experiences, that's practice. That's real practice. And just circling back on this evening's theme, I think that this willingness to return again and again to experience as it actually presents itself is the ultimate fresh start. So with that, I would like to turn off the mic and turn the discussion over to all of us.